The Mike Lupica Podcast.
We are back now with the great Mike Lupica. He's one of the country's
Mike
most
Lupica
prominent
has covered just about every sport.
Candid interviews with legends he calls friends.
I was talking to Jordan about Woods after the basketball game. Mm-hmm. The other night. Everybody in sports to be the next this guy, the next this guy. And Michael said, no, he's the first Tiger.
In your face questions.
How much of a dope is he?
Compelling.
A billion-dollar industry, the biggest we've ever had in sports in this country, often comes down to a flip of the coin.
This is the Mike Lupica Podcast. Here's Mike Lupica.
Hello, and thanks for joining us on the Mike Lupica Podcast. Today we'll be talking with one of the most talented people I know, Hank Azaria of The Simpsons and Brockmire and so many other things. But before we get started with Hank, we'd like to tell you about our great sponsor, Gillette. Gillette has been part of my day for as long as I can remember. A truly great brand. There was never anything else or anything close. My dad used it. I use it. My sons use it. You know what you're getting each time you use it, and that's a great shave. The high-quality craftsmanship of the blade is perfect, and I'm even a big fan of the Fusion Gel Cream. Used it this morning. My friends at Gillette have great news to share that makes it an even better experience. You can now get Gillette Performance delivered right to your door. Subscribe today and get every fourth order free. Check out Gillette online at www.gilletteondemand.com. Welcome to the Mike Lupica Podcast. My guest today is someone I didn't meet. I met over email, but I didn't officially meet in person until the Mets were on their way to the World Series in 2015, and we were both acting like lunatics during the Cubs series and having to be seated. My sons and I were seated pretty close to where Hank Azaria was. Hank Azaria is one of the most talented people I know, and I'm required to say that because he once played my friend Mitch Albom in the Tuesdays with Maury television movie. He has become legendary for his work on The Simpsons. He is currently starring, and we'll get to this today. If you have not seen Brockmire, which is about to start in about 2 months, its second season, you are missing one of the funniest. Hank, first of all, Hank, welcome. And second of all, I guess we can start with Brockmire because to me, it is the television version of Major League. It's that funny.
Well, thanks, Mike. Good to be with you. Can you hear me well enough, first of all? Am I coming through loud and clear?
Yes, you are, my friend. Yes, you are.
Very good. Thank you. Yes, it's not too often. I guess there actually have been a few real good baseball movies, Bull Durham and The Natural is one of my favorite movies. Not so many great baseball comedies.
Right.
But Major League's definitely one of them, at least the first one. And Brockmire, you know, I love baseball. I love baseball announcers maybe even more than baseball itself. This is sort of my weirdo love letter to all that.
We're talking to Hank Azaria on the Mike Lupica Podcast. And when we're talking about Brockmire, in which, okay, I'll try to bumper sticker this, and then I want you to tell me how it came to be. Jim Brockmire was once the play-by-play television radio voice, right, of the Kansas City Royals. And
actually, television voice.
It was television. It's right. I'm picturing the opening scene. Okay, but poor Jim has a bit of an episode one day doing a Royals game, having walked in on his wife in the middle of an orgy. And Jim locks himself in the broadcast booth and is drinking heavily. And Hank, you take it from there.
Well, whenever I talk about what happened to Jim Brockmire, it's helpful to talk as Jim Brockmire, as
sure,
I'm doing right now. This is the generic baseball announcer voice I grew up with in the 70s and 80s. Jim, probably 4 or 5 beers, a couple of shots of whiskey at a normal broadcast. This one, he stepped it up a good bit after just walking in on his wife. In a blackout, I think it's safe to say a blackout drunk.
Right.
Goes into a lot of detail about what he just witnessed and how he feels about it on the air. And there's a few comedic premises that went into this for me over the years. One is, do guys like this, do these baseball announcers, do they always sound like this, even when they, you know, do they leave the ballpark and come home and go, hi, honey, I am home. What is for dinner? I tell you what, I could eat a horse. And I mean that literally. And do they dirty talk like this in bed, which we explore in episode 2 of season 1, which will be out on Hulu Friday. Season 1, you can watch Brockmire season 1 on Hulu Friday. And season 2 comes out April 25th on IF. And then also Harry Shearer and I, I work with The Simpsons. He does an unbelievable Vin Scully. Anytime you hear Vin Scully on The Simpsons, that's Harry. And it's one of those impressions you can't really tell the difference between the real Vin and Harry. Yeah. And we were chatting over the years, and Harry mentioned baseball. And have you noticed that baseball announcers can say whatever they want as long as they give the count right afterwards? So, you know, that leads to Brock Meyer saying, you know, I walked in on my wife. She was dildo deep in our neighbor as Johnson looks at a fastball. 1-0. Stuff like that, which I never find, never doesn't amuse me, that nonsense. And towards the end, Vin really kind of engaged in a lot of that with some of those political rants he went on, and then we kept the count in there. It was kind of amazing.
And we're talking to Hank Azaria, the Mike Luka podcast. So in the when the first season is of Brockmire is available, you have to watch it because, and Hank has heard me say this before, the first 10 minutes are as funny as anything I've ever seen because you don't just see and hear what Brockmire is saying. There's a lot of cutaways to these nice Royals fans within the sound of Jim's voice running and trying to cover little children's ears as he continues to give not only the play-by-play of the game, but this hideous description of what he had walked in on with his wife.
Exactly. I think it's right when Jim is saying, hey, for you kids at home, a strap-on is a dildo that mommies wear to penetrate daddies as Pedro delivers a fastball into the dirt, 2-0. You had to see the effect it was having on the viewers at home, sure, if you're going to melt down like that. Also, a fellow Med fan and I, we always would often, like, make fun of the announcers and imagine, like, if they said certain things, what would the penalty be? Like, if they said that,
right,
would just be called into their boss and talked to. That would be suspension, for sure. That one would be definitely fired. So we'd often play that game, like, what if an announcer said it? What would be the consequence? So Brock Meyer was birthed out of that stupidity also.
And so the setup, again, I urge you to see it, and because then you'll just want to be ready for season two. The setup is, obviously, this piece of video and footage and sound goes viral, and it ends his career, and a lot of bad things happen, and he ends up with a team. And by the way, you should have hats or T-shirts. I hope there are hats and T-shirts. You end up, Jim Brockmeyer does, with the Morristown Frackers in the minor leagues,
yeah,
who are owned by Amanda Pete, which is, you know, that's not exactly heavy lifting for you, I assume, Hank, working with Ms. Pete and a wonderful young actor, Terrell Jackson Williams. And that really begins the action of the series.
Yeah, that's 10 years later. He's, you know, as he says, he's spanned the globe, calling every kind of sporting event there is, ended up in the Philippines, calling the cockfights on television, which they really have, by the way, right? They actually televised cockfights.
Yeah, sure, of course.
And, one is desperate to get back into baseball to kind of find his better self, figures by now everyone's forgotten about him, doesn't realize that the internet exists. He's literally such an old school guy and gone so under the radar that he doesn't realize that he became one of the first viral videos, you know, a la, you know, the Grape Stomp Lady or Winnebago Man or whoever.
Yeah.
And so he's way more, he's huge. He's a meme. He's an icon. He's known as, he's a verb in our language to Brockmire someone. Means to tell the brutal truth. So he is starting over again at the bottom of the barrel minor league team, having to sort of combat his own, you know, internet image, and it becomes this like fish out of water man from another time, which kind of how Joel Church Cooper and I, Joel, who writes it really brilliantly, we sort of saw him as this relic from another time, as baseball kind of is, you know. And it's like, what if somebody who embodied baseball had to enter the modern era? It was another premise of the series.
And Hank, we've talked about his Brockmire's wardrobe before, but as a Queens kid, you obviously had to have been influenced as a Mets fan by some of those sports jackets that the late great Lindsey Nelson used to wear.
Oh, the Brockmire jacket is a direct lift, not from Lindsey's actual wardrobe, but what I remember of it. And that polyester plaid seemed to just sum up. It seemed to be the the garment equivalent of that voice to me, even though Lindsay didn't exactly sound like that. But yeah, and I found that jacket myself in a thrift shop in L.A. I think I paid $12 for it. It's still the jacket I wear.
That much, huh, for that jacket that you wear in the premiere episode? You had to go as high as $12, huh?
Might have been 18 somewhere. It was definitely not higher than 20.
Was there one guy, you can answer this as Brockmeyer in his voice, was there one guy whose voice was in your, and you're such a, obviously we'll talk about The Simpsons in a minute, but was there one guy's voice that was in your head as you began to conceive who and what Brockmeyer was?
No, there really wasn't. I think the closest that I can recall listening to was Rick Monday.
Really?
Yeah, Rick kind of has this going on if you listen to him. And Harry Carey Jr. got a lot of this in him.
Yeah.
And I still hear this voice currently in Saturday afternoon basketball, like your average NCAA Saturday afternoon game, you get this guy a lot. You get this guy who kind of delivers it to you the way you used to get it, Mike. And but it was even more than it wasn't just the baseball sports announcer voice. It was also the TV pitchman voice. You know, it was like the generic announcer voice in our culture.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the Ginsu,
yeah.
Ronco, Popeyes, kitchen magician. Always seemed to be sold to you by a guy who sounded like that.
It's what Dan Jenkins, Hank, it's what Dan Jenkins used to call Captain Big Voice. That's who Brockmeyer is. He's Captain Big Voice.
Exactly. That's a perfect name for him.
When you started it, okay, did you, and obviously if when you watch this, for people who haven't seen it yet, you'll see that there are real life people from baseball in this. Joe Buck is in it. Have you had many turned from people who know who Jim is? Have you had turndowns from real people that you've asked to do guest shots?
Yeah. most people, it's just kind of the generic, oh, I'd love to, but I'm not available. But I think, you know, one of my heroes, actually, Frank DeFord, had agreed. And then I think took a look at the script. And, you know, Frank's an older guy. I think he was like, I don't think this is for me.
Yeah.
And I can't blame him in the least.
Apparently,
I wouldn't even dare show it to Vin Scully. I'd be afraid, literally, like be like showing my grandpa, you know, the porn I watch or something. I don't think I could bear to do it, you know.
Apparently, my invitation got lost in the internet or social media someplace because I don't.
All you guys, you cry these blues. Nah, that's been a happy sort of bittersweet byproduct. There's a lot of sports guys now really guilt me about not being in the show. Listen, season three. Mike, you want to be in season three. We already shot season two.
All right. I'm in. We're talking to Hank Azaria on the Mike Lupica podcast. Okay. And this is a longer conversation that maybe we can have in one podcast. Did you have any idea when you started with The Simpsons that it would become that and you would have had this kind of run?
Well, no, you'd have to have had a psychotic break to imagine. Can you imagine if I said, yeah, it's this cartoon show, primetime cartoon show. It's on an upstart network. If you remember back in 1989, there was CBS, ABC, and NBC, and that was it. I'm sure you do remember. And there were no new networks. There was your two local channels and PBS. Besides, and then your public access or whatever, and that was that. And cable, well, at this point, we had cable, but they sort of were separate elements, right?
Right.
HBO and developing, but that wasn't, they didn't cross over. And so a new network, broadcast network, was unheard of, which Fox was. It was in its second or third year of existence, so you didn't even think the network would necessarily remain, let alone a show on the network, let alone for, you know, going on now 30 years. It's insane. The show became a huge hit right away.
Yeah, it was. It was a rocket to the moon right away. And I was reading back on it today. Mo was your first voice?
Yeah, Mo was the first voice, Dave. And that's and, correct.
And it is true that you based the voice of Mo, at least in part, on Al Pacino.
Yeah, most of these voices are sort of bad, hackish impressions. Some better than others, of either celebrities, family members, friends, relatives, teachers, whatever. you know, a bad impression is a good original character voice, I like to say, Mike.
Yeah.
And
I
was, you know, the young Al Pacino, Mo kind of sounds, old Al Pacino kind of sounds like this, right? The Al that we know today is like this. Yeah, all right. Al, you know, Dog Day Afternoon Al, Michael Corleone Al was more like this, right? It was a little higher up here, very soft-spoken.
Yeah.
And I was doing a play in L.A., I was playing a drug dealer where I was kind of doing a kind of Pacino thing like that. And I auditioned as that for Mo, and Matt Groening said, who's the creator of The Simpsons, said, can you make it gravelly? We'd like the voice to be gravelly. So if you take young Al Pacino and you make him gravelly, you yeah. get Mo the Bartender, Mike. That's the math. That's The Simpsons math for you there.
And did they... Did they, this is an odd way to ask this, but you're an actor, so did they love you from the start, or was the relationship a work in progress?
No, I was 23 years old when I walked in there. It was like one of my, it might have been my like third or fourth actual job in show business, you know, and I had no idea what I was doing. I really didn't. And, so they had to kind of teach me a lot. Like I learned on the job, and they didn't make me a regular on the show until like about a year later. I was week to week, and every week I thought it would be my last because I seemed to annoy them with my inexperience each week.
Yeah.
which I don't blame them. I had no idea what I was doing. I really didn't. I didn't know how to, you know, do a joke or what pacing was. I didn't know or anything. So, yeah, no, I learned on the job. I have no idea how I got so fortunate. Then I found out years later, Mike, that there was an original, there was another guy who originally did the voice of Mo.
I didn't know. You know what? I didn't know that.
Yeah. And I always assumed they just weren't happy with what he did, you know? And then I found out from Matt Groening like a decade ago. I said, so why? I finally got around to asking him after 20 years. Why did you fire that guy?
Right.
why did you not like what he did? And Matt went, oh, we really liked what he did. We thought he was awesome. I'm like, well, now I'm doubly curious. Why did you fire him? And he goes, oh, he was just a dick. He was a jerk to everybody.
And there you have it. And then they just continued to call you back, and then they continued to draw. Because I wanted to ask you today, because I've never asked you this, what is it like to be a breakout star? Did you know you had this skill? I guess that's the long way of asking this. I mean, your career path, obviously, was to be an actor, and you started out in stand-up and all that stuff. But all of a sudden, this thing turns you into a breakout star.
Well, you know, The Simpsons really didn't, Mike. I mean, I was under the radar. I mean, you do voices. Nobody really knows it's you.
That's what I'm trying to add. Yeah, right.
It has lasted so long that now people, and then I've gotten known for other things, and so now people know, mostly, that that's me. I'm the Simpsons guy, or one of the Simpsons guys. But it took many, many, many years. It would take a show being on 20 years, 15, 20 years, which has never happened before, for people to sort of catch up to that. No, I have had a very incremental career. I mean, I'm a character actor. I'm not a big movie star. I haven't even had, you know, apart from Brockmire, every show that I've really, I've been on some great shows like Friends and Ray Donovan and others, but anything that I've had as a vehicle never really panned out so well, professionally, creatively or commercially, except for Brockmire. You know, that's one of the reasons why I'm thrilled with it.
We're talking to Hank Azaria on the Gillette hotline on the Mike Lupica podcast. And when you, but you've won Emmy awards, right? For outstanding voiceover work, right?
I won four for The Simpsons. I won one by playing your buddy Mitch, and I won one for Ray Donovan last year, or year before, or whatever.
And by the way, you were a scream. I was going to get to this later. A scream in The Birdcage. You were a scream.
Oh, thank you so much. I won a SAG award for that. Yeah, that was really actually my big break. That's what got me, you know, into known, at least within the industry and in movies and considered for TV shows and considered for big parts and things. That was, if I had a big break, that was probably it.
We're talking to Hank Azaria. All right, let's talk about Tuesdays with Maury, which is, you know, my pal Mitch's came from my pal Mitch's best-selling book, which sold like the Bible. And it's about weekly visits to his dying college professor. Hank, what was it like to work with Jack Lemmon?
It was genuinely amazing. You know, he was a hero of mine. The guy was a legend. Certainly by the time I walked onto that set with him, he was, you know, Mike, he was very open. Like, he was very open with information and sharing and you know, very accessible, almost to a level that really surprised me. Most big actors are not, I mean, they're nice. Many of them are kind but he was very, you know, very intimately, personally open, not just with me, but with a lot of folks, almost to a point where you wondered what was up. And it turns out he was, in actuality, and he also said shooting that, as we were shooting it, not even when we were done, that it was his favorite role he had ever done, which, listen, I thought it was good, but, you know, that's saying something coming from Jack Lemmon. I mean, I don't know that I'd necessarily agree with that, quite frankly. But it turns out, Mike, that he was very, very ill. He was terminally ill.
That's what I was going to ask you. He was already starting to, Hank, he was already starting to fail, right?
He was. So I think that the material, you know, what Mitch wrote and the script that got turned into was very personal for him. And he felt like he got to sort of die on camera as kind of a goodbye. I think he did one more project after that, maybe one more, but he very much felt like, you know, he was an actor's actor, and he got to sort through a lot of his own feelings about his mortality and dying in playing that role. And I kind of realized that halfway through, and it sort of hit another level for me. I'm like, my God, I'm witnessing Jack Lemmon fade, and I'm watching him act doing it, which is certainly a privilege. And he's also sharing a lot with me about, he didn't go into a lot what it was like to be ill, and he wasn't open about that. We just found out about that, but he was very open about the craft of acting and, you know, what his childhood was like and how he felt about his father and all amazing things you wouldn't expect someone like that to share.
We're talking with the great Hank Azaria on the Mike Lubica podcast. More with Hank in a minute, but first this from Geico. When shopping for car insurance, consider this. Geico has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money. Talking to Hank Azaria on the Gillette Hotline, that was one of the first times you had done drama, right? You were in The Cradle Will Rock, but this was like your first, you talk about breakout roles, that was your first dramatic breakout role, right?
Yeah, I mean, I had done some in the past, really nobody ever saw, and I certainly studied for years. You know, I felt ready to do it because, you know, years in an acting class, I wasn't particularly doing comedic scenes. But yeah, no, it was the first dramatic role that I got any recognition for, I guess.
And by the way, Hank, it also, in the law of unintended consequences, that movie produced one of the most bizarre award show moments I've ever seen in my life. When Ving Rhames wanted to give his award to Jack Lemmon.
Yeah, I think that happened actually at the Emmys or the SAG Awards? I can't remember which that year, but yeah.
I think it was the Emmys.
Yeah, you might be right. That was...
And poor Jack is looking like he's having an out-of-body experience as Ving is demanding that he take his award.
I know. I wonder if Ving regretted that. I wonder if Jack gave it back to him.
We're talking to Hank Azaria on the Mike Lupica podcast. And you have wandered through some very famous sitcoms, Friends and Mad About You. And when I was reading back on you today, you read for the role of Joey Tribbiani in Friends?
Yeah, twice. It's the only time I ever bowled my way back in after being rejected once. The only time I've ever, first and last time. A lot of my friends, Matthew Perry included, we all knew the show was going to be great. We just, every once in a while, a script comes along, and we were just the right age to be able to appreciate it, you know, and know that, oh, this has captured the voice. It's really funny. It's going to be good and fun to do. And I just couldn't let it go. I just so desperately wanted to be in it that they very kindly saw me, and they very courteously threw me out for a second time. That was fine.
And there have been other series that you led, and one of them was a show that I liked called Huff. Talk about Huff for a second.
Yeah, that was a good show. That show I actually was proud of. That one came out well. Got canceled after two seasons, but it was one of Showtime's early dramas from about, oh, I guess like 12 years ago or so. And it's about a shrink who's got his own horrible problems.
Right. Yeah.
And to me, that show was really, Brockmire kind of is too, but Brockmire is a much darker comedic version. There was elements of a lot of humor to Huff as well, but Huff was really about addiction. I mean, it didn't say that it was, but everybody in Huff had some addiction issue they were working out, whether it was, drugs, booze, sex, food, codependency, whatever it was. That writer, Bob Lauer, is a great writer. He really understood that dynamic really well. And that's what that show was. And yeah, it was hard to make. It was a pain. But just as we were figuring out and enjoying it, they canceled.
What was it like? You've intersected with so many interesting and amazing people in your career. What was it like working with Redford on Quiz Show?
That was amazing. That was that movie directly led to my getting the Birdcage because Mike Nichols, legendary director, writer, saw me in Quiz Show and so cast me in the Birdcage. So I was a pretty young guy, and Redford, he was very kind and patient man, loved, still is, I'm sure, loved, obviously was very passionate about film, and was happy to teach you the tricks of filmmaking, tricks of film acting, which was amazing, because there's things to know about acting for the camera that you don't know when you're starting out. And he knew all of the rules and was happy to share them. Things like, you come in, you do a take, go, that's great. When you react to that, just look to your left instead of your right. Trust me, camera will like it better. Things like that.
Yeah.
He broke down. He said, when you come in, when you notice him, do a double take. I'm like, oh, Bob, I'm not sure how to do a double take. He gave me the anatomy, the ABCs of doing a double take. Look at something, look away, then quickly look back at it. That's all it is. Stuff like that. It was so cool to have a Robert Redford teaching you all that stuff.
All right, wait a minute. So Mike Nichols sees you play Albert Friedman in Quiz Show, okay? And he slaps his forehead, Hank, and says, oh my God, I have found the man that I need to play a gay Guatemalan housekeeper in the Birdcage.
No, that didn't happen. What happened was Mike liked me in that and said, I want to put you in the movie. You're definitely in the movie. Come read it, do a table reading, which is when actors sit around and read the script at a table. That's the term table reading. And he said, I want you to do 4 or 5 of small roles, like just read all these small roles, which actors do a lot, especially when they're starting out. You kind of fill in you know, because you want to cast it with 28 people sitting there at a table read, which I did, which was my job every week on The Simpsons anyway. And one of the roles I read was this two-scene part of this Guatemalan houseboy. And he said, what role would you like to do? And I said, oh, I'd like to do the Guatemalan houseboy. And Mike was kind of surprised at that. He said, yeah. Okay, I guess you did that well enough. Sure. And then about it originally, though, was supposed to be that character just had one or two scenes. And then as Nathan Lane's dresser. And the role of, like, the maid, the servant, the butler, however you want to refer to him,
right, yeah.
Was going to be a black character, like in the original French film, and I believe was going to be played by David Alan Grier. And then they decided that in an American context, having a black servant, an African-American servant, it was just in poor taste. It was just offensive. And it didn't translate well into American humor. So they decided to make it Latin, and because I had done well at the table read, they combined the roles and offered me that larger part, which is how that sort of came to be.
We were talking with Hank Azaria on the Mike Lupica podcast. Hank is joining us on the Gillette Hotline, and we were talking about Pacino and how he kind of inspired the voice of Mo in The Simpsons. And I had forgotten you worked with him. And De Niro, and John Voight in the movie Heat.
Yeah, a long time ago, right around this. In fact, I shot The Birdcage the same time I was shooting Heat, which was a real dichotomy of experience. And yeah, I really only worked with Al. I mean, obviously De Niro and John Voight were in the movie, but I didn't work with them in it. And worked with De Niro last year on Wizard of Lies, which was really fun. The Bernie Madoff HBO film.
Oh, I know. Yes. Oh, yes. You were in The Wizard of Lies, weren't you, Hank?
Yeah, giving that guy's philosophy. He's very sensitive and empathetic, and I would say pre-Me Too movement take on his assessment of women. Let's
yeah.
just leave it at
yeah,
that.
I think that was extremely well put. Yes, that was very well put.
I don't know if that crazy monologue makes it in a movie today. I bet it doesn't.
I was told this has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but I am writing because I didn't have enough to do with writing the books for kids. I'm writing an adult mystery that picks up a character that my dear friend Robert B. Parker once had. And
he was your dear friend. He's my favorite. I'm a maniac for those Spencer novels.
Oh, well, here's them. Hank. Here's the thing. Yes, he was a friend of mine, and I knew him really well. And he wrote Spencer. He wrote Jesse Stone, which have been made into TV movies. But he also wrote, interestingly enough, he wrote a character called Sonny Randall. A Boston.
Based on my ex-wife.
I think Helen Hunt and Bob had a conversation, and she said, come up with a character, and he came up with Sonny Randall. So,
I connected the two of them.
Well, okay, so let me reconnect this whole story. So my agent, Esther Newberg, represents the Parker family. And I, believe me, I wasn't looking to do this. And last spring, I said to Esther, people have picked up the Westerns. Ace Atkins is doing the Spencer novels beautifully. Reed Farrell Coleman is now doing the Jesse Stones. How come they never resurrected Sonny Randall? And she said, I'll get back to you on that. And she literally called back an hour later and said, I talked to the editor. I talked to the family. Would you mind writing a sample chapter? And I said, no, not at all. And so I wrote it. And away we went. I've now got 50,000 words written. It's going to come out at the end of this year. It's the most fun I've ever had. As I've written this dialogue for Sonny Randall, it has occurred to me how much of an influence Bob's work had on me when I was writing mysteries 1,000 years ago. But the point of the story is the outline I submitted, Hank, last spring was about a sexual harassment case at a big network. And when I submitted the first 100 pages later, they said, we love this. You've got this character down, but you got to do something else. Because one of the things was, nobody wants to really touch that material right now, especially in Hollywood.
Right, yeah, sure.
Hank Azaria, by the way, is a New York kid. he is a New York sports fan, and I have already stated that, and we'll talk about the Mets because I have hope for the Mets. Hank, I met the new manager the other day, and you are going to love Mickey Callaway. He became, he's great. And Hank, talk about weird career arcs. 10 years ago, he's a player coach for Laredo in the United Independent League, okay? And now he's managing the Mets. And I was talking to another general manager, and I told him how much I like Mickey Callaway. He says, once he got into the interview process with other teams, everybody knew about him. And the Mets got him. And he is, you know, he's the pitcher whisperer, okay? He did wonders with the Cleveland Indians staff.
Yeah,
he believes all those young guys are healthy again. And as one Mets fan to another, I'm telling you, there is hope again, Azaria. There is hope again this season.
All right, and yeah, like enough about my career. Let's talk about what's really important.
Sports. All right. You can't have a worse week than the Knicks have had. And we've talked before how you have suffered for a decade and a half, during which the Knicks have lost more games than any team in the NBA. They have won exactly one playoff series since the year 2000. One, okay? And finally this kid comes along, Porzingis, who gives them hope, who gives you hope, who is a ray of sunshine, and his knee explodes on him a few days ago.
Well, which is horrible, but let me ask you a specific question, a general question. I love asking this question of fellows like you who made a career in sports.
Okay.
Because as somebody who is a sports fanatic, and especially a New York sports fanatic, but it really that doesn't matter. And especially when you root for teams like the Mets and Knicks and Jets, and you're perennially disappointed. And, you know, we all know the demeanor of Mets and Knicks and Jets fans.
Yes, we do.
The doom is insane. But, you know, it feels like there are times when the casual fan, or at least the knowledgeable, maybe not the expert, but the knowledgeable fan,
right,
can see things a little clearer than management at the time, you know. And there's certain things that happen and you go, look, either this is too simple and that's why management doesn't see it, or it's too complicated and I'm not understanding the nuances here.
Right.
But for example, to me, you know, you can't be surprised. I mean, I didn't see torn ligaments for Porzingis.
Right. Right.
But one can't be surprised that he went down. I mean, you know, he's done nothing but that.
Right.
Right. I mean, and all this, nobody was more thrilled than I was the first 20 games of the season when he was at not all-star, but MVP level. But I kind of knew it couldn't last. I mean, even if he didn't get hurt, he just doesn't seem to have the strength and stamina and durability.
And he's 7'3". Yes, you sometimes wonder, you look at, and he doesn't play like Nowitzki, for example. Okay, Nowitzki is a guy who runs down the court, and this is a kid who likes to run the court and run and jump. Hank, you're 100% right. As gifted as he is, and he's a unique player. Larry Brown says he's got one of the most unique skill sets he's ever seen. He's 7'3". Okay.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah.
But he has looked like an accident waiting to happen. And there was nothing about the backstory here. The backstory meaning what led up to this injury to make you think that he was built to last. And I think the last time we talked, we were joking about this. Dude, you can't talk about being tired in December.
Oh God.
Come on.
I love that he's honest. But I mean, unfortunately, I think he was just being honest, you know, and he looked it.
He did look tired. So what? Explain to me, okay, because one of the mysteries of the universe is again, this is a level of ineptitude that with one of the iconic franchises in sports, playing in as iconic a setting as there is in sports. Explain to me why that building continues to be packed.
You know, I've talked about this with my poker buddies many a night. You know, it's you can't deny how much fun it is in there. You know, it's still
right.
The Mecca. It more than I think any other any other sports arena or stadium. I've never been to Lambeau. I hear that's pretty incredible. I used to love going to Fenway.
Lambeau, Hank, Lambeau is all that. I've taken my son twice. I have a son who's a Packers fan. It's the power of the Sunday ticket on DirecTV. Lambeau, you must put Lambeau on your bucket list. You must, even if it's 97 degrees below zero.
I hear it's amazing, but I'm always happy sitting in there, even when the Knicks are getting blown out. There's just something about the energy in this place. And we talked about this a little bit last time, too. I've now got this strange reverse engineered pride as a New Yorker that doesn't matter how my team is doing, we all show up, don't we?
Right.
You know,
right.
It's kind of like this amazing brotherhood, if you can afford the ticket. So I don't know, though. Yeah, people just keep going. But it's a little tough to watch. Once again, we have sort of slid back. But, you know, wait, getting back to my premise.
Okay.
To transpose it to the Mets. See,
yep.
There's two guys over on the Mets that, to me, I've seen enough to know. I know how this season's going to go for them. I'm not talking about Harvey.
You're going to talk about Cespedes, aren't you?
No. Yeah. He gets hurt a lot. He does, for sure. But he's an older guy. Okay. But no, Max and Darno. Haven't we had a large enough sample size? I think so.
Especially Matt's. I don't see how. I'm much more optimistic that Zach Wheeler is built to last than Steven Matz, who's a great kid, by the way, and he's a local, you know, he's a Long Island kid. But I have more confidence in Wheeler, don't you, than Matz?
Yes, I mean, we'll see if Wheeler can find. I mean, I don't know what his problem was last year, but I know. But in his ability to stay healthy, for sure.
But I'll tell you what, Todd Frazier is a great pickup for the Mets. Great. I actually think
I like
great.
That very much. Would you have rather had Moustakas, or are you happy with Frazier?
I would absolutely rather have Todd Frazier. I think that Mike Moustakas is one more guy out there in a mediocre free agent class who has wildly overestimated his value to any other team other than the one on which he's been playing, which is the Kansas City Royals.
Right. I mean, I got to say, and I really liked Todd Frazier's early interviews and then, you know, looking into his numbers. I know he, you know, isn't a high batting average, but God, that's an amazing on base percentage given his batting average. That's pretty awesome. And stability, right? A guy that you can, I mean, watch the Mets, you know, have the first season he only plays 80 games will be this one. But a guy you know is going to be down there. Fielding the ball consistently is pretty nice.
But I think the manager is, I think he's going to do great things with the pitch. All right, let's talk about your football team for a second. The football season is over, but it never ends for Jets fans. And I have two friends from show business who are crazed Jets fans. One is the person to whom I am speaking, Hank Azaria, and the other one is Mr. Larry David. Okay, and Sundays in the fall, even though it comes from a place of misery, Hank, are really fun for me. And I'll have to put you in this chain, okay? Because once the game starts, Larry starts to text me, and the question is this. And by the way, Hank guested with us. If you haven't listened to the Sports Reporters podcast, is really fun. And Hank's going to hopefully have a recurring role in that. And you can go find that. Okay. But we talked about this. They have been looking for the next Namath, Mr. Azaria, since Namath. Since Namath. It's 50 freaking years. Okay. It's 50 years. And when you add it all up, Hank, the best quarterback they have had since Joe Namath was Vinny Testaverde, who had a year that was actually statistically as good a year as Namath ever had. 29 touchdown passes, 7 interceptions, and, well, you know what happened in Denver. They're a half away from going to the Super Bowl, and they're still looking. This is a long way of asking you this. Do you want Kirk Cousins?
Yes, it's a short answer, just because there's no better option. And, you know, where is it going to come from? We talked about this a little on the Sports Reporters. I really wanted them to tank this year so they could have a a shot at Darnold or Rosen or
the kid from Wyoming. Yeah, Josh Allen.
That would have been nice. But yeah, I would take I would absolutely take Cousins. You know, just to be able to stand what I'm seeing from the quarterback position is a nice change of pace over the last decade or so. You know, Rex got in the AFC Championship game a couple of times. But I also told this in sports reporters. It's why I irrationally hate the Indianapolis Colts, because they somehow managed to go right from Peyton Manning getting hurt, 1-15.
Yeah, but they didn't have a very good week, Hank. Hank, you must have been happy, okay? The Colts didn't have they didn't have that great a week.
They did not. They look like they're really headed into a downward spiral in the foreseeable future. We'll see if Andrew Luck can come back. I'm happy that they're miserable, as Jet fans are every year.
All right.
And, I would take Kirk Cousins. Wouldn't you? Would you? No? Yeah.
Well, here's what I would do. Yes. Yes. I think he's better than Neil O'Donnell, and all Jets fans know what I'm talking about there. I think he's a much better football player than Neil O'Donnell,
who
is going to.
He's no Ken O'Brien, but he's
no.
better than Neil O'Donnell.
But here's, I would not make a single move with Kirk Cousins until I called the champions of the world and found out what it might take to get the guy who just won the MVP of the Super Bowl, because I think Nick Foles is a better football player than Kirk Cousins. And it's going to be a very interesting thing, don't you think, to see what the Eagles
agree.
Are going to do with this kid.
No doubt. He's, you know, what do you attribute him to, right? Because that season with Chip Kelly,
was great, though, Hank. It was great.
That season? Did he actually break some records that season?
He was 27-2. Hank, I think he was 27-2 when 27 touchdowns and 2 picks when Kelly was his coach.
Yeah, and his QB rating was insane.
Yep.
And then what did he do? Go to the Rams? Did he go to St.
Yeah,
Louis?
He got in Chiefs, Rams, I think, and he got into some. You know, it just shows you how important it is to be in the right system. But Hank, how much do you love that he went to Doug Peterson and said, "Hey, we ought to try this play down on the goal line"?
Unbelievable, really unbelievable. When I heard that detail, I just like, wow. I mean, because that play in itself was just amazing, let alone that he drew it up on his palm.
It was
like you wouldn't have sandlined. Crazy.
It was. But here's the thing about Foles and why I think you have to find out if he is actually available and if you could get him first. You know, I don't think you can any longer get him with a second round pick, which is how the 49ers got Garoppolo. Okay. But when there wasn't one, Hank, you watched the game, there wasn't one moment in that game where you thought, oh my God, Foles is nervous, or he wasn't up to what I always call the circumstances of the occasion. He played that game like he was the same as Brady and had played 7 other Super Bowls before it.
It was amazing. It was so great to see. You know how much I don't enjoy the Patriots. So,
oh, really? No, really? You've hidden that so well, Hank. Is that true? You don't like the Patriots?
To watch, you know, a team giving them as good as they give and not getting out coached in the second half. And I don't know how that game turned into did it set a record for yards gained?
It was crazy. Well, Hank, you know this, and I said this to the people I was watching it with. It was a good game from the jump. There were no lags in this game. It was they're just moving up and down the field the whole game. I mean, it was even funny when old grandpa was out there in the flat trying to catch a pass as a quarterback. That must have been your favorite play.
That was one of the happiest moments of my life when he dropped that pass. And he kind of – didn't he look like Eli Manning looks after he dropped it? He had that Eli look on his face. It was fantastic.
Yeah, come on, Grandpa, run a little faster. Get those hands up, Gramps. Come on.
I know. Come on, reach for the ball. Are you kidding? It was great.
Hank Azaria
to catch one. Yeah, it was awesome.
Hank Azaria, tell everybody again when the second season of Brock. Well, first of all, when it's available. First season's available on Hulu. When?
This Friday.
this Friday, and then the second season of Brockmire, April 25th?
April 25th is episode one on IFC.
And fortunately, this is a huge break for me. I'm already in some way, maybe I can get Costas too. You know, Garagioli used to call Costas and me the bookends. Maybe Costas can come along for season three.
I'll tell him that you approved that you're giving him the green light. I'll let him know.
Hank Azaria, again, he is one of the most talented people I know. He loves to get to do what he did for the second half of this podcast, which is talk about sports. Again, I urge you to watch Brockmire. A wonderful career is ongoing, and I might not see at the ballpark, at the Garden anytime soon, because there's absolutely no reason to watch the rest of the season, but hopefully I will see you at Citi Field this season. Thank you so much for doing this today.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Hank Azaria, if you listen to this podcast, we've moved past 100 episodes of this. The audience continues to grow. It's this kind of conversation. Fortunately, I've been lucky enough to get to talk to the people I want to talk to. Please download it. Please subscribe to it. Go to the comment section and leave a comment, and we will talk to you next week, everybody.
The Mike Lupica Podcast is produced and distributed by Compass Media Networks in conjunction with Hiltzik Creative. For iPhone users, go to the podcast app and search the Mike Lupica Podcast. Click on the Mike Lupica Podcast icon and subscribe. For non-iPhone users, you can listen on Google Play Music, TuneIn, Stitcher, or your preferred podcast platform.